For great-looking t-shirts, hoodies, and sweatshirts, the TNT Shop is now open at tntradio.live. Exploring solutions to the mental health crisis. This is Mind Medicine on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Well, dear listeners and viewers, wherever you might be on the planet, welcome to the Mind Medicine program in association with Mind Medicine Australia. I'm your host, Charles Coves, Australasia's passion provocateur, speaking to you from Melbourne, Australia, not Melbourne, Florida. It's Saturday, the 14th of January for me, so that'll be Friday night in the US of A. It's great to be with you. This show is all about how and why mind matters. Of course, your mind matters. It's going to give you ideas to provoke new ways about thinking about your life and life generally. We're going to give you insights into mental health issues and health issues of all descriptions, including your financial health, believe it or not. And our guest in the first hour, who I'll be introducing shortly, is Dr. Jerry Brady from Queensland, Australia. And the second hour of the program will be Dr. Arlen Tombolson from Adelaide. But your financial health is a crucial element to your mental health, because if you're stuffed financially, you won't be feeling good mentally. Now, I said we are bringing this show in association with Mind Medicine Australia, and we are thrilled to do so. It is an important mental health charity. Mind Medicine Australia is Australia's leading not-for-profit organisation working on the use of medicinal psilocybin and MDMA-assisted therapies to treat a range of mental illnesses. Some people say psilocybin. So I first heard it as psilocybin. I've heard both descriptions, so take your choice. Mind Medicine Australia exists to help alleviate the suffering caused by our accelerating mental illness epidemic in Australia through expanding the treatment options available to medical practitioners and their patients. The website is mindmedicineaustralia.org.au. Unlike current treatments such as antidepressants, which only manage the illness and can have nasty side effects, psilocybin and MDMA-assisted therapies have been scientifically proven to be a safe and effective cure for anxiety, depression, end-of-life stress, addictions, and post-traumatic stress disorder after just a short treatment program. These medicines are also currently being researched for dementia, eating disorders, obsessive-compulsive disorder, and a range of other conditions. Research from over 160 trials indicates that the medicines are safe and non-addictive when administered within a medically controlled environment and lead to remissions in 60 to 80% of patients after just 2 to 3 medicinal sessions in combination with psychotherapy. Get this, everybody. There have been no adverse events in over 3,000 patients, unlike outrageous COVID bioweapons that are being jabbed into people. Both medicines, psilocybin and MDMA, have been granted breakthrough therapy status by the FDA to fast-track their approval. This designation is only given to medicines which may prove to be vastly superior to existing treatments. Mind Medicine Australia is dedicated to helping the rapidly emerging global movement to spread awareness and ensure these medicines are available to those who desperately need them via the medical system. Visit the website mindmedicineaustralia.org.au and spread the word. Your family and friends need these solutions to their mental health challenges. Don't struggle along with psychologists and psychiatrists for 10 years. Look into these alternative solutions and support Mind Medicine Australia. This show is also about passion and its impact on your life and health. So I have been Australasia's passion provocateur for 29 years since I left my successful legal career. And my definition of passion is that it's a source of unlimited energy from your soul, your spirit, your heart, that enables you to produce extraordinary results, extraordinary. When you are passionate, you are above ordinary. And the picture I invite you to have in your mind is that when when you pursue your passion, you're coming from your soul, your spirit, your heart. And fear comes from your mind. Whilst this is the Mind Medicine Program, I guarantee to you, I'm willing to go on the line and guarantee to you that if you are pursuing your passion, you will be healthier than if you're not doing so. I want to share with you my definition of health. Most people that I talk to, and I say to them, and Jerry, I can talk. Jerry, I'm going to give you prior notice here, Jerry Brady. You know, what is your definition of health? But I'm going to give you mine. And it comes from the Hungarian word. I'm president of the Australia-Hungary Chamber of Commerce, and I speak fluent Hungarian, and the Hungarian language is very precise. And the Hungarian word for health is egészség, which means wholeness, being whole. That's whole. And don't forget the W, and that's important. So being whole is what it means to be healthy. So my definition of health is the unique optimum balance for you of mental, physical, and spiritual elements. The unique optimum balance of mental, physical, and spiritual elements. So think about that in the context of your own life. So I hope for you many benefits from listening to this show, and I want to just cover a couple of things that are relevant before we talk to Jerry in this first hour. I am a freedom warrior, and I'm delighted to have a show on TNT Radio. TNT Radio fights for freedom, and I fight for freedom in five ways. I said before, I come from a Hungarian origin. I was born in Australia, but my parents were refugees from Hungary to get away from communism, to get away from totalitarianism. So it's almost cellular in me to fight for freedom. And my proposition to you is if you do not have freedom, you are not much different to an animal. And government's strongest sanction in Australia and most countries around the world, there's not many places with death penalties, well, there are quite a few, but certainly in Australia, there's no death penalty. So taking away your freedom is the strongest sanction government has against you. So get this, you know, the people would give away their freedom for this illusion of security. I never would. And I fight for freedom on this show, freedom of speech. And as I'm chairman of the Australian Institute of Comedy, and comedians are being absolutely hammered, no ability to speak freely because of political correctness and wokeness. And this show, as you well know, if you're a regular TNT listener, there is no censorship. This is a free speech environment. I was a lawyer for 20 years, and now I'm also working as a legal strategist. The law is a way that we preserve freedom against government overreach. I'm CEO of an industrial hemp company, and farmers who grow hemp will enable themselves to have successful family farms. I fight to educate people about health, because my proposition to you is if you are not healthy, you are much less free. And obviously the best example of that is if you're locked up in a hospital because you're not well, you are not free. And lastly, passion. I fight for you to be free to pursue your passion. So a couple of things that have happened that are relevant. Archbishop Cardinal George Pell died during the week. And I was raised a Catholic. And I'm sure Jerry Brady, with a surname like Brady, was raised a Catholic. Anyone called Brady is a Catholic. George Pell was Australia's most senior Catholic authority. And he died at the age of 81. Now, I'm planning to live till at least I'm 120, and I believe that he was knocked off. I believe he was knocked off in the Vatican because he was investigating the corruption and the criminality that's happening within the Catholic Church. I will stand by that belief, and until someone does an autopsy on him that it comes from a reputable body, I wouldn't be interested in anyone's view about, oh, yes, our view is that he died suddenly, you know, blah, blah, blah. So have a think about that, and don't be seduced into thinking how sad it was that he miraculously died suddenly. The other good bit of news is Novak Djokovic coming back to Australia. Now, I happen to know Novak personally because one of my good friends is one of his health advisors here in Melbourne. And Novak, the reception of Novak in Adelaide, the tournament prior to the Australian Open that's starting here in Melbourne, was absolutely positively spectacular. And I think some comfort in the fact that people understand the gaslighting that has happened with this COVID response, that Novak could not come to this country without getting jabbed. He said, stuff you, I'm not going to put a poison, I'm not going to put a bioweapon into my body. And the question was asked of him, would you give away your career to preserve the integrity of your own body? And he said, yes, I would. And he did, and now he's welcomed back with open arms. I think that's wonderful. And the last matter I want to talk about, I won't talk about Joe Biden and the sheer hypocrisy of him holding all these classified papers, is the issue of sudden death. So George Pell, Cardinal George Pell, was a sudden death. But there are, you know, Lisa Marie Presley in the last 2 days. Everybody speak up and just tell everybody it was clearly the jab. It was clearly the COVID jab. Unless someone produces a proper autopsy that it wasn't, because this sudden itis that's going on, these coincidences that are going on, are clearly BS. So there you are. There's a bit of a story of where my brain is thinking. And in the second hour, I've got other matters of editorial that I will talk about. Now, Jerry Brady, Dr. Jerry Brady, who I've been working closely with for 1.5 years, I think, just a bit over 1.5 years. Jerry has been a guest with Mike Ryan on TNT Radio before, but I'm gonna ask you much more difficult questions. No, I won't. He's a doctor of medicine, retired, graduated from the University of Queensland, 30 years of patient-focused clinical experience in medicine, unlike Anthony Fauci, who never treated a patient in his life. He's the founder of COVID Under Question, cross-party inquiry by members of the Australian Senate and Federal Parliament in March last year. The videos are available. Done on the 23rd of March. Excellent, excellent overview of what the COVID response by government is doing. He's the founder of Your COVID Daily newspaper in 2021. It's a wonderful newspaper, CMN News. That stands for COVID Medical Network News, cmnnews.org. Download that. Jerry tells me that's all you have. If you follow that first, and I'm going to ask him why that's all I have to follow, that'll help me deal with the flood of information. He's the founder of Boom Finance and Economics in 2015, a weekly newspaper and blog on global macro financial matters. He's the co-founder of biopharmaceutical research and development company in 1990, which dealt with genetically manipulated microorganisms, large-scale fermentation and anti-cancer therapeutics. He's the co-founder of one of the first internet mapping companies, first to map the internet, not one of them. He was the first to map the internet. That's the IP address to geographic location. That was 23 years ago, and his publications I've mentioned, and he has lots of special interests, particularly finance and the monetary system. Dr. Jerry Brady, welcome to the Mind Medicine program.
Thanks, Charles. Thanks.
Your CV takes too long to read, but I think it's important for people to understand, because I want our listeners to understand the depth of your work.
Yeah, my CV is a bit long, it's extensive. I get bored easily. I'm very, very curious about the world.
Well, that's the question that I had, the first question, because like me, you changed your career from a successful doctor to what you did, and I changed from a successful tax lawyer to a passion provocateur, so I became a professional speaker. So answer that. Why? You know, what gave you the courage to step out and do something different?
Well, it wasn't a matter of courage. I don't think it was courage for me. I saw it as a logical step. I just decided that I had done a lot of medicine. It was a very stressful life being a doctor, incredibly stressful. I was a helpaholic. I really wanted to help as many people as I possibly could. And I helped many, many people. I mean, there's no doubt about that. But I was a little bit burnt out. I sort of realized I was a helpaholic, and that was not a good situation to be in when you're a doctor, to be a helpaholic. So I just decided to change my life. I had a few things happen in the business world that led to that decision as well. I mean, my involvement with starting a big biotechnology company, then my involvement in starting a company that mapped the internet, they were formative sort of experiences that changed me from being an ordinary doctor to being somebody else. And then I wanted to also pursue my interests in economics and finance a lot, because I'd always been interested in that area.
And unlike most doctors, Jerry.
Well, yeah, most doctors, and also most people have got no idea about economics or finance. And so I was just different. I was curious about that world, and I wanted to learn more about it. So I thought, all right, I'm going to get into this world. And I did so. And I started a newspaper in finance and economics. It's a global publication. It's very specialized. It's aimed at the top people in the world of finance and economics. So all of that was driven by curiosity and the endless desire to learn. I'm a learnaholic as well. So I'm a helpaholic and a learnaholic. I love learning.
I like that. Helpaholic and let me just take a note of that.
Yeah. So I love learning, and I learn every day voraciously. I read voraciously across a wide range of topics. I haven't always been like that. I mean, when I was young, I wasn't all that interested in learning. In fact, I got through university fairly easily. It wasn't difficult for me to do a medical degree. I sort of, more or less stumbled through that, although and when I finished it, I wanted to be a really good doctor, and I think I did achieve that. But, I didn't have that voracious urge to learn. It's grown as I've gotten older. And it really took flight when I retired from full-time work, because I could then just learn all day, every day. It was fantastic. And that's 15 years ago now, and I'm still learning. I mean, I just love it. So, voracious learner.
So give us your perspective. Because it's my experience, I've had lots to do with doctors. My first as a young lawyer back in 1975. 75 was a crucial factor in the health industry in Australia, because that's when the doctor-patient relationship turned into a ménage à trois, Jerry. The French word meaning a three-way sexual relationship. But the three-way relationship now meant the doctor and the patient and the government, because 75 is when Medibank came in, as you well know.
Yeah.
And then all these doctors suddenly had a tax problem. They were earning much more money. And they came to me, and I've had lots to do with doctors since, and I'm amazed at how little doctors know about finance. But you know lots, so you're a voracious learner. So, and I've worked with you in trying to help people to understand finance. And I really would, we've got a three or four minute opportunity here before we have to go to a break. Give us a sense of what we should be thinking about finance and money and your financial position.
Okay, very, very quickly. 99% of people don't have any idea what money is. They have little idea what wealth is. But money is a mystery. It's even a mystery to the economics profession. The vast majority of them don't really know what money is. They're not taught about money. So money's a really unusual subject. Money is basically a promise from one person to another, or from one, say the government to an individual. So these promises can be written down, and they become what we call promissory notes. That's the term, promissory note. But all money is basically a promise. And in fact, it's all money is basically a debt. So money is a debt. It's written as a contract of debt. So at the moment in Australia, 98% of our money that when it's created new is created as a bank loan. And you have to enter a contract with the bank when you create that money. The bank doesn't have the money that it's lending to you. It creates it when it creates
the loan. Explain that, because that's a view. Explain that beautifully. Just unpack that for a moment.
Yeah, it's a very critical thing to learn. A lot of people think that the government creates money and somehow issues it. And that's not true. The government creates some money, which is cash. But the vast bulk of new money is freshly created when a bank loan is created. And the vast bulk of those bank loans involve a mortgage over a property. So therefore, the creation of money in our system is linked to the value of property that's already in existence or that's going to be built in the future. So that's really important. The government is only really producing 2% of the money supply in the advanced Western economies at the moment, 2%, which is cash. So cash, notes and coins, they're basically issued by the government. It gets the banks to distribute the cash. Okay, so there's a joint sort of arrangement. Government, Treasury decides to increase cash and the central bank will issue it. That varies from country to country, depending upon the central bank constitution as to how that all operates. But basically, sovereign money, which is non-interest bearing, is cash. Whereas bank-created money in a bank loan is interest-bearing, and they're the two big differences. So the other big difference is that bank loans, more often than not, are tied to an asset as collateral. So money created by government or cash is interest-free. It's not connected to any asset as collateral. It's essentially, believe it or not, it's a loan from the sovereign to the people. In lots of ways, and it can be recalled. So, but that's a complication, really. The fact is that the government only produces 2% now of the money supply. Now, in the past, in the 1950s, it was totally different. There was almost no credit being issued by banks after the Second World War. So, therefore, who created the money? The government did. It got the cash and it created cash and ran the economy basically using cash. Now, everybody will remember getting paid with an envelope, a yellow envelope, brown envelope with cash in it every Friday.
That was so exciting when I got my first cash, yeah. With cash in it.
Yeah, I used to help my father make the cash envelopes for the employees that he was involved with. And we had about 100 employees that he was involved with. And I had to help because it was just such a big job. And we had to calculate their tax, write their little tax slip and put that in the envelope, put the right amount of cash. Everybody got cash. Just about the entire society got paid in cash. It didn't matter
Was that in the 50s? Gosh, because I got my first pay packets, my first official pay packet in 1969.
Yeah, it was still in existence in the late 60s. It was it was reducing, but late 60s, that was still happening.
But certainly in the 50s, almost everybody, wasn't a credit into your bank account, was it? No
way. There were checks, but there were bank accounts and there were checks. You'd have to write a check to draw money out of your bank account. There was a whole system of doing that, and you'd have to go down and deposit cash into your deposit. So everything's changed totally. We've now got the exact opposite of what we had in the 50s and 60s. We've got an economy that's dominated by credit money, money created with interest attached to it in a bank loan. The banks, of course, don't want 98% of the money supply. They want 100%. So now what they're trying to do is get rid of electronic cash or cash at all costs. They want to get rid of all cash, right? They also want to get rid of electronic cash because, you know why? Because central banks don't make any money out of cash, neither do commercial banks, okay? So there's no money to be made. So if they went from 98 to 100, they'd be quite happy. They're making money out of the last 2% then. So, but that's basically a quick resume. We could go on and on about what money.
No, that's it's very good. And what would you? Well, we'll talk some more about that. But I love your understanding of money. We've got to go to a station break. And after the break, we're going to turn our attention to COVID and the attack on our freedoms. But I'm also interested in, if we've got time, to unpack why people should learn about money and finances. I think that's a crucial mental health issue. I'm Charles Coves. You're on the Mind Medicine Program. I've got Dr. Jerry Brady here. You're on the Mind Medicine Program. I've got Dr. Jerry Brady here from Queensland doctor, finance guru, learnaholic, and helpaholic. We'll be back after this short message.
You should hear what Dirk Pohlman is talking about.
Dirk Hammarskjöld was the second General Secretary of the United Nations, a position the superpowers regarded as a bureaucratic job without much influence, because that was what they wanted Dirk Hammarskjöld to be. But in a very short time, he gained a reputation which could be called exceptional to this day. A man who combined diplomatic skill with an ability to get things done. The death of Dirk Hammarskjöld is one of the biggest conundrums of the Cold War. Hammarskjöld was killed in an aircraft accident in 1961.
By legitimizing the Soviets and coming from a country which provided some of the world's best living standards and offered a lot of personal freedom, he sort of was a trailblazer for a lot of people in the Third World who looked up to Sweden. The Sweden of the 1980s was so successful and so democratic. It was almost more of a threat to the Anglo-Americans than the Soviet Union was, with its obviously failing economy and its, you know, dictatorial trends.
The Dirk Pohlman Show on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Affordable housing, we can build that. Sustainable housing, we can build that. At MIT Modular, we understand the importance of housing for all and the importance of design, cost, and functionality. Our goal is to meet the needs of our growing population by converting shipping containers to livable units. If you're like-minded and in a position to invest in something meaningful and life-changing, we want to hear from you. We are a team of professional architects, engineers, and financial and tax experts dedicated to offering unique solutions that provide a brighter future. Our Opportunity Zone Fund offers investors both real estate and operating business diversification, 5-year tax deferral on capital gains, annual tax benefits, and ultimately tax-free appreciation potential. There are Opportunity Zones all over America. If you're interested in learning more about our services, need affordable housing, or want to participate in creating a new vision for tomorrow, give us a call in the U.S. on 385-985-5702. Or read more at mitmodular.com. MIT Modular. We can build that.
Are you listening?
Yeah, I'm listening.
That's all you have to do. We'll do all the talking.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to the Mind Medicine Program in association with Mind Medicine Australia. I'm Charles Kovess, your host, and my guest in this first hour is Dr. Jerry Brady. Now, I shared my definition of health at the top of the show, and I've asked Jerry for his definition. All right, Jerry, what is it? Hit me with your best shot.
Well, this is a really funny one. When you're a doctor, you deal with all sorts of things regarding with health and disease, but you're mainly a disease expert. What you do is look for disease all the time and try to then manage it. And the ultimate thing is to try to prolong people's life and stop death from occurring. So you think a lot about, well, what is health? You know, what it really is. It's very difficult to define, but there is one absolute indicator of health, and that is death. If you're dead, you're not very healthy. If you're alive, you're healthier than the guy who's dead. So, in other words, who are the healthiest people in our society? Well, they're the ones who live the longest. At the end of the day, they ultimately live longer than everybody else. Therefore, theoretically, they are healthier than everybody else. It's a pretty strange definition, but it's nice and clean. So it gets you out of the mess of trying to work out what health is versus unhealth. A lot of people, of course, never achieve wholeness, as Charles referred to, because they might be born with a problem, a genetic disease of some sort. So they never, ever get the chance to achieve wholeness. So health for some people is just about impossible. And other people, of course, are dealt a very bad health outcome through their life. You know, I've seen many, many situations like that. Usually it's genetic or some infection or something, and that they're not expecting. So you've got to look at these people who are really old and who haven't died. They're the ones who've got the clue. And then you've got to look at the nations where people live longer, because that's a lot of clues in there too.
We'll have an unpacking conversation, Jerry. Because not today. We'll have you back again. But I often quote Michael Crichton, the author, and so we have this conversation. You know, matter of science, and the government says the science is settled. And Michael Crichton has this beautiful quote, everybody, that When someone tells you the science is settled, reach for your wallet.
Yeah, perhaps. The other thing I just might mention in this discussion about health, Charles, is mental health, because that's what your show's about. Now, when I started practicing medicine, which is 1977, that's a long time ago, mental health issues were not very common in the GP's office and the general practitioner's office. Okay. So you might see the occasional person with depression or anxiety. You might see some florid psychotic reaction in some people, but it was pretty rare as a general statement in the day-to-day general practice. When I finished practice 30 years later, it was the biggest part of practicing medicine. So mental health problems went from the smallest part of the doctor's job to the largest part in a general practice setting.
Good. And it begs the question,
yeah,
why?
What happened in between? Yeah, there's a whole lot of things that could happen in between. We could talk about that. A few things happened that were a bit unexpected. Number one was we finally had some treatments for people. We didn't have treatments really when I started. We didn't have any.
Yes, we did. I object, Your Honor. I object. And here we are. We had cannabis.
Yeah.
We had the wonder where all these herbal solutions, didn't we?
Yeah, perhaps. But in terms of, say, the doctor's ability to intervene and so with pharmaceuticals, we had very ordinary antidepressants. They took a long time to work. They had a lot of side effects. And, you know, maybe people didn't turn up at the doctor because there was no great treatment. There were also very bad adventures in the world of medicine with regard to drugs like Valium. And so people just didn't come to the doctor. But when I finished medicine, boy, it was enormous. The mental health overload that doctors are dealing with is huge. The average citizen's got no idea what the average doctor deals with on a day-to-day basis. But a lot of it is just stress, anxiety, depression, like all sorts of things, you know, obsessive-compulsive disorder. I could go on and on, but it's a much bigger problem than it used to be.
Well, how do you deal with, so take you, rather than giving medical advice, because you don't do, how do you deal with stress and mental health and, you know, depression challenges and all that?
Well, I was fortunate genetically. My genetic background is one of resilience. My father was the most even-tempered person I ever met. He's just amazingly even. My mother suffered enormously from physical illness throughout her life and was more or less an invalid for the last half of her life. But she didn't generally allow that to get on top of her, and she was very courageous in dealing with all of her illnesses. So there was courage on her part, and my father was just this very even-tempered man. So I was blessed genetically from both of them with, I guess, the temperament which doesn't sort of reach extremes too much. I'm pretty stable in that respect. Also, when I became a doctor, I had to learn to survive being a doctor. It's an incredibly tough job, very stressful. So I had to go through all of that when I was younger. And as I get older, I got more resilient, I guess, through getting all through all of that. So that's just my personal journey.
Yeah, but hang on, you had to go through it. But, you know, give our listeners a clue. Well, okay, Jerry, you did it and the stress increased and you handled it. Give us a couple of tips on how you, looking back, well, I haven't asked you to prepare on this.
No, how did I cope?
Yeah.
Okay, well, the biggest thing I did was I took holidays, plenty of holidays, and we always went away. I said, we've got to leave the home when we get a holiday. And we took a lot of holidays, and that's how I coped. I couldn't have coped without them. And a lot of doctors make the mistake of not taking holidays. And so they just get worse. They're burying themselves in more and more stress as the time passes. But that was our biggest thing, was the holidays. And we used to take our family off on holidays, and we'd rent a van and go for a trip where they're all trapped in the van. And you just travel from motel to hotel or whatever and wherever you were. And that was fantastic. And the kids loved it because we were by ourselves. We'd cut ourselves off from the rest of the world, and we were a family unit traveling.
And you didn't have mobile phones.
No, there were no mobile phones, and that's very important. We weren't connected at all with the world. Mm. Mm. We could travel in that van and drive around, and we had to talk with our children and become get to know them. And we tried to make our children resilient as individuals. And I think those holidays helped a lot. They all learnt to become an individual inside a family group. So that's my tip for, you know, for anybody, is take plenty of holidays. It's really important to get away from the work and the grind if you've got a stressful job. That was my trick.
That's a very good, it's a very practical suggestion.
Yep.
And we've got recordings of all these conversations. So I always ask that question of my guests. And by the way, today is the first anniversary of this show. I did the first show on the 15th of January last year, Jerry. So we had a couple of weeks off. This is every fortnight for 2 hours. So this is episode number 24. So how about that? A year goes by so quickly.
Yeah. Oh, just one other thing I'll say. I did mention my genetic predisposition, I think, was good. But there are a lot of people aren't blessed with that. You know, they come from families where there's a strong family history of mental illness. There might be, I mean, nearly everybody I saw with depressive illness had a family history, and our genetics manifests as we pass through life. And some people are born with very unfortunate, genetic situations. They're sometimes born with terrible physical diseases and physical disabilities, and some are born with mental disabilities. So as a doctor, you've got to cope with all of those people out there who aren't what we might call whole. They're actually the opposite of whole. They're struggling with all these things.
So you're comfortable with my proposition that if you're not mentally whole, then you wouldn't describe yourself as particularly healthy, would you?
Yeah, I think that's sort of true. But I'm just trying to sort of point out that we're surrounded by people who are struggling their way through life. Mm. They are born with sometimes with physical disadvantages or mental disadvantages
Irish disadvantages.
Yes, of Irish disadvantages. Or sometimes even worse. I mean, they're attacked as children. They're treated badly as children, and they come from a position of not being found their own self-worth. When you're a doctor, you're confronted with all this pain in society. It's there and it's hidden. People will smile to you when they walk past in the street, whatever, but they may be carrying a great unseen burden. And you've got to be compassionate. One of the greatest things I learned as a doctor is to be compassionate. You've got to be compassionate and consider other people all the time. So I think that's important. When you're a doctor, you have no choice. If you don't become compassionate as a doctor, you are not a doctor, in my opinion.
So I've done mental health work for 29 years, Jerry, as a facilitator, as a speaker. I'm an executive coach, and I go pretty deep with a lot of people. And as you're sharing that, you know, everyone needs to understand that you can't build resilience without these challenges. You know, you can't read about resilience to get resilience, and yet if the burden is too much, and it's an interesting balance in life, isn't it? And you take a holiday because the burden was getting too much. I need to let go of the burden. And so that's what we have to learn, everybody. We need to raise our self-awareness to go, gosh, how am I? Am I thriving in my life? And if I'm not, then I need to do something about it. But the fact that I've had to go through a tough time, I'll say it another way, tough times are not to be avoided, because that's how we build resilience, isn't it?
Yeah, I think learning, we go back to the subject of learning. Learning is an incredible thing to build into your life, because every day then you're doing something to contribute to your knowledge. For instance, last week I wrote my finance editorial, and one of the sections I wrote on it was about the Ukraine war. And I was interested in Western Ukraine, and particular Poland's connection to West Ukraine. And I knew almost nothing about this. So
I bet
on.
You don't know that in the west of Ukraine, there's a significant Hungarian minority.
Well, I did learn that when I was doing the research.
Okay,
but I learned that Poland has a very long history in the Western Ukraine. And a lot of it is very, very tragic. In 1945, Ukrainian Nazis And it wasn't German Nazis, apparently. It was Ukrainian Nazis, murdered 100,000 men, women, and children. And most of them were elderly or young, obviously, in Western Ukraine. And they murdered them in terrible ways. And this is why Poland is not a great friend of the Ukraine. And I didn't know that. And so, but I learned all this, you know, it was great. So, and then I learned about an area just near there called Transnistria while I was doing this research. Now, Transnistria is like an independent state on the border of Ukraine, between Ukraine and Moldova. And it's a little tiny slither of land where I think it's about 200,000 people live. And they are seen as a part of Moldova. However, they think they're an independent state. They even have a central bank. They have their own currency. They register their own driver's licenses. And it's quite amazing, Transnistria. Now, you know, what an amazing thing to learn that there's this little tiny semi-nation, they call themselves an independent state, with a central bank sitting right on the border of Ukraine. And I had heard of this, but boy, it's interesting to read it. And you go to Wikipedia and the entry on Transnistria is enormous. You could read all about the history of Transnistria. Wow. And by the way, the Russian army have been there for 30 years. In Transnistria, they've got a base, 1,500 troops, and they've been there as peacekeepers. The Russians have been there since 1992, invited in as peacekeepers since 1992. And you think, well, this is amazing. You know, you didn't know this before. So I find that incredibly exciting to learn things that I've never learned before, you know.
And that learning process then, Jerry, that seems to then enable you to handle, you know, life's tough, but you get excited by the new learning. Yeah. It handles the tough bits of life.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think people who think they know everything about the world are pretty short-sighted. There's so much to learn. I'm at the moment doing some research on a certain part of technology, and it's vast. It's massive, and I'm getting overwhelmed. I've never even looked at this technology before. So you can pick a subject. You might like, I have a son-in-law. He chooses little areas of history. For instance, he's interested in Hungarian history, funnily enough, and he's done all this research on Hungarian history just because he got started. And then he said, wow, this is amazing what happened in Hungary in the last 1,000 years. And he just kept reading and reading, and he loves it all. It's just an accident that he got into that subject.
Tell him, and he will know that Hungary is the oldest continuous nation in Europe. It was founded in 896 AD.
Yeah, but I mean, it's all learning. You might get interested in being a great mechanic, although you might, during the daytime, you might be a clerk in the public service, but you might decide you're going to get really interested in how to build engines. Well, just go and learn.
That is a lovely clue that learning, the excitement of learning, can help you handle other stresses that you have in life.
Yeah.
Now, Jerry, the medical profession, I want you to be as provocative as you like here. What's your view of, let's talk about Australia, but there's a global, and I don't think there's much difference globally, but what do you want people to think about how the medical profession has performed in relation to COVID, particularly over the last 3 years?
Well, I used to be a proud member of the medical profession. I thought we did a lot of good, and we were very disciplined, very professional in what we did when I was involved. However, now I'm extremely disappointed in the profession. Since the SARS-CoV-2, the so-called COVID phenomenon started, I think the medical profession has dropped the ball really badly. Most of the spokesmen from the medical profession just don't seem to know what they're talking about. They've done virtually zero research on the technology that's in these so-called vaccines they want to inject into everybody. They don't seem to know anything about the technology when there's a huge difference between these vaccines and what were standard conventional vaccines. Massive. It's like saying that say you said the past of transport was motor cars, you know. It's like comparing a motor car to a jet or to a rocket that takes you to the moon. Yes, they're both vehicles, but You know, you can't. This is so different. So you've got all this prior technology of what's called protein vaccines, very well developed technology, and then all of a sudden this rocket appears called mRNA technology, and it's also called a vaccine. And you just presume they're the same thing? They're not. They're not. You can't even begin to compare an mRNA vaccine with a conventional vaccine. They're just nothing like each other. And in fact, we've discovered that these new mRNA vaccines don't stop you getting the illness, the infection, and they don't stop you spreading the infection. So now they say, oh, yes, but it reduces your risk of hospitalization and death. Well, hang on, that's not what a vaccine is really supposed to do. It's really supposed to stop transmission. So are they or are they not vaccines? That's very questionable. Are they safe? Are they effective? If they're effective, in what way are they effective? You know, how are you measuring all of this? I think the medical profession really, it hasn't looked at that aspect of how different this technology is. They've just come out with the same mantras that the politicians have told them.
Yes, I think that's the key, isn't it? The doctors refuse to do their own thinking. And you've made a comment in the past that medicine is no longer being practiced. It's really it's dictated by government.
Yes. Actually, when I finished practicing medicine, I noticed the government was starting to interfere more and more and more. That's one of the reasons I did stop and had the opportunity to go and do something else. But it's gotten worse and worse and worse. I think the government's very heavily involved now in medicine to the extent where the doctor really can't do anything but do what the government tells them to do. That's very, very sad because, you know, the one place you can go to in our society where you might get a confidential discussion and, you know, an opinion that you can value was always at the doctor's surgery, particularly the GP, the local GP. But that is being undermined. And quite a lot of doctors are caught in the middle, of course. Some have just decided to leave. We've lost a lot of doctors in the last 3 years. They've just left. They're not prepared to have the vaccine. They're not prepared to tell their patients lies, and they just leave. And I know lots and lots of doctors have left.
Is that right? I hadn't heard. So give us a sense of the numbers.
Oh, well, I think you've just got to look at the...
A lot.
Look at the hospital system at the moment. Look, it's it just can't cope. It just cannot cope. We were always able to cope in the past. I saw a TV show the other day about the UK and how they had ambulances lined up outside a London hospital, and they were saying that they just can't cope with the demand. We never had all of that. We just got on and did it. You know, we didn't have those problems. I think it's pretty self-evident that a lot of doctors have left.
A lot of nurses.
I know a lot of nurses who've left, and they're now, very disappointed.
Jerry, I've had everyone on with Jerry Brady, Dr. Jerry Brady, experienced doctor, but now experienced finance guru. I call him a guru. What should people be saying to their doctors, people who are on the side of truth and justice and freedom, which is what TNT Radio is about, when they walk into a doctor's surgery, you know, because I've had examples where people ask the doctor, what research have you done on these COVID jabs? Yeah. And almost all doctors say nothing. I'm just following the government line. So my question is, if I have to go to a doctor, which I spend my life avoiding, I hasten to assure you, what do I say? Mm. Well, what do people say?
I think you ask the questions. You've got to do some research. You've got to do some learning yourself first, you know, and it's easy to find. You can go to the internet and look up a lot of good sources for finding information. Go to cmnnews.org. It's a newspaper type thing. Lots of information for you to learn there. And ask the doctor how they define safe, very simple question, and how they define effective. And then pointedly say, well, where's the evidence for what you've just said? You know, you've got to put them on the spot. You do it in a non-confrontationalist manner because the doctor's already buried with work and responsibility. He doesn't need anybody.
Yes. Oh, there's a big problem there, isn't there? The doctors are financially stuffed.
Yes, they are. Financially, they're in a difficult situation, but also there's just an endless stress of being a doctor is there. And so you've got to be sympathetic to their plight. But nonetheless, you've got to have a good conversation, an adult conversation with them about what is this phenomenon? What is this thing called COVID? You know, and is it a big threat? And are these products safe and are they effective? And just get into the nitty gritty, take along some research and say, look, this doctor over here said this. What do you think of that? And this chap said this. What do you think of that? You've got to get into that situation. You can't just sort of accept the words safe and effective and we'll do what the government says. You know, the governments, they know nothing really about looking after people. You know, politicians, very few politicians have ever been a doctor. They don't know anything about looking after sick people. And even the doctors who work for governments, they don't look after sick people. They're chief health officers. You know, they're sitting inside a bureaucracy, filling in forms and, you know, going to this committee meeting and that committee meeting. They're not seeing patients all day long. So the governments and their advisors are very limited in their experience.
Yeah. Yes, it's this idea of technocracy, and Patrick Wood, I'm a big fan of. For those of you who have never heard of him, look up technocracy. It was an invented word in 1938, Patrick says, and this idea that you know, life is too complicated for politicians. Let's just leave it to the technocrats.
Yeah, well, there's an interesting point here I'd like to make, and that is there's a very big difference between science and technology. Science is what we do, where we try to work out what the world is made of or how the world works. Technology is what comes out of science. Now, people have started to worship technology, and they're calling it science. So they say, follow the science. I follow the science. Hang on, no, you follow the technology, mate. You don't follow the science, because the science is always seeking to find the truth through debate, through uncertainty, through questioning, and the technology is just what pops out at the end. It's the last little manifestation, like a internal combustion engine, you know, comes out of someone's ideas about energy. So science is one thing, technology is another, and they've decided they're going to worship technology. But they're going to call it science, and that's definitely not the case. I'd like it if they want to say follow the technology, follow the, you know, that they're believers in technology, follow that. I'm fine with that statement, but this follow the science. Science is not a religion. You don't follow it. It's endlessly about questioning, about hypothesis, about testing, about proving things, proving a hypothesis, or about proving one hypothesis versus another in probability. It's all about uncertainty. The technology that pops out at the end, like, yes, the plane does fly, you know, that's technology, all right? Yes, we put the plane up and it flies. There it is. But the science is all about the questioning about how we're going to get this plane in the air. You know, it's a bit of metal. How are we going to work it out? How are we going to design the wing? What metals are we going to put it in? Then we can have an argument about all of that, and we can have a hypothesis, and we can test and test and test. And then at the end of all of this process of science pops out a piece of technology that we call a plane, an aeroplane, and it flies. And we go, oh, wow, it flies.
Yeah. Okay, it's totally different. It's science versus technology.
Technology, yep.
I love it. Okay, now I've got another big question for you. We've only got two minutes to go. Can you tell us about community banks and why we have to use community banks?
Okay. I would not use that term. I would say we've got to use community-owned banks. Nice. Now, those banks are banks that are not shareholder-owned, so they don't have shareholders. Okay. Now, some banks call themselves community banks, but they are actually shareholder banks.
And yes. Bendigo banks are community banks.
Yeah, they call themselves community bank, but it's not a community-owned bank. It's a shareholder-owned bank publicly listed on the stock market. So the key thing is to understand who owns the bank you're using. Now, community-owned banks tended in most countries to have come from credit unions, okay, building societies, savings-type institutions that have developed over many decades. And eventually, over a long period of time, they were given banking licenses and became banks. Now, there are a lot of these around, and you can find them, community-owned banks. They don't generally call themselves community banks. They actually just call themselves a bank. But if you can find these banks and support them, that's very, very important over supporting shareholder-owned banks. So this is a revolution in banking that we could generate. Yeah.
Well, I'm appalled. You and I were involved with helping a pilot who has been wrongly sacked by Virgin, and the case is going forward, but he had some money in an account and the bank simply froze the money, and then for 6 weeks he had no access to money. And the behaviour of these shareholder-owned banks leaves a lot to be desired, Jerry.
Yeah, definitely. I think if you've got to understand this, in Germany, 70% of the banking industry is community-owned banks. And they're called Raiffeisen, R-A-F-F-E-I-S-E-N.
I've seen that word. Okay.
Raiffeisen. And these banks are owned by their local communities. There's no shareholders. And they're incredibly resilient banks. Very resilient banks.
Okay. So everybody, Jerry, we're in the last minute. We're going to be stuffed for time. So what we've learned from Dr. Jerry Brady, genius, is take lots of holidays, do lots of learning, help lots of other people, build your resilience, and find some community-owned banks. There are plenty of them in Australia and right around the world, correct?
Correct, right around the world. There are not all nations, but most Western nations have these.
Thank you, Jerry. Thank you for joining us. We've got Arlen Tompelson coming on in the next hour. And Jerry, we'll have you on again. Thank you. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, Charles. Well, I hope you-